Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio is an examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the inescapable, indelible, and indispensable influence of drugs on society. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being drug users. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when drug users are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. Harm reduction is a set of practical strategies and ideas aimed at reducing negative consequences associated with drug use. Harm reduction is also a movement for social justice, built on a belief in and respect for the rights of people who use drugs. This week on Free Culture Radio, we look at harm reduction and trace its development from the first syringe exchanges in the 1980s to safe injection facilities and heroin maintenance today. Our guest today is a physician, a pioneer in the harm reduction movement, Dr. Alex Wodak. Dr. Wodak is an emeritus consultant with the Alcohol and Drug Service at St. Vincent's Hospital. He's a visiting fellow at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales, and he is the president of the Australian Drug Law Reform Foundation.
Well, I became involved in advocacy really for HIV prevention. That was in the early 1980s when my family and I had come back from living in London, and we came back to Australia, and I was working in a part of Sydney that's a little bit like, say, Times Square used to be in New York or Soho in London. So it was an area with a lot of tourists go there, and the drug trade and the sex trade are very well provided for in that area. And that's where Australia's national HIV epidemic had its epicenter among men who have sex with men. In the early 1980s, several thousand got infected in a very short period of time. And I was worried about a cascade of HIV infections starting from men who have sex with men, going through people who inject drugs, and then going on from then to the general community. And so I was worried about us having a generalized epidemic, which happened in a number of countries, starting with people who inject drugs. So that's what I was worried about, and I started working with a group of people that we put together, and we realized that the fastest way of preventing this epidemic from occurring would be to provide clean needles and syringes, and we had to do that on a big scale, starting very quickly. So I applied to the government for our group to be allowed to do this on a pilot basis, and I got back. I was knocked back about 13 times, and then I realized I was never going to get permission. So our group then engaged in civil disobedience starting on November the 12th, 1986, and the police investigated me and the group and decided that they were not going to press charges, and so the government had no alternative but to allow lawful needle exchange to start to take place in late 1986. And the good news was that a generalized HIV epidemic was prevented, and many tens of thousands of HIV and hundreds of thousands of hepatitis C epidemics were prevented. Billions of dollars were saved. So the next year after that, 1987, I was thinking in my office one day, why had they tried to stop me? Because it was accepted that what we were saying was true, that this was the HIV epidemic was a serious threat to national health and well-being and the national economy. That was, everybody agreed that was right. It was agreed that the population of people who inject drugs was critical to controlling that infection in that population and in the general community, and that needle exchange seemed to be the most likely way of interrupting that epidemic, averting that epidemic. So why are they trying to stop that? And it became clear that there was a clash between the desire to protect the public health of in Australia and the desire to protect drug prohibition, the national drug policy. So I started thinking, why did Australia adopt drug prohibition? Did it work? Were there better ways of managing drugs? And I started talking about this in public in 1987, getting a fairly hostile reception, I might add. And so that's how I got started in this. And then I traveled in the United States and some other countries to look at how countries were managing HIV among and from people who inject drugs. And I had two critical experiences in the United States that really helped me a lot. One was with in the State Department in Washington, D.C. I met the deputy director of what was then called the Bureau of International Narcotic Matters, now has a slightly different name. And there I was in a room that was opposite to the entrance of the suite of offices for George Shultz, the then Secretary of State. And I said to the person I was meeting with, deputy director of that bureau, I'm starting to wonder whether drug prohibition works. Can you give me any arguments or data that shows that drug prohibition does work? And he said to me that the US dollar had depreciated against other currencies. That meant the business of the State Department had become more expensive. That meant that the budget of the State Department had to be revised. And every section of the State Department had taken a hit except for embassy security and drug policy. So I thought, well, okay, what's he really saying to me is that who cares whether it works or not? It works bureaucratically, and that's all that matters. So that was really quite impressive for me. And then in New York, I went to see, I spent an evening in a shooting gallery in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And I saw four Hispanic people, two men, two women, inject speedballs of heroin and cocaine for a whole evening with reckless disregard for their health. I established that they had all heard about AIDS, that they knew that people who inject drugs were at high risk, and that they knew that some people they knew had got AIDS and died because of catching HIV through sharing needles and syringes. And yet there they were. And that evening really deeply affected me. And I think anybody who wants to think or talk or write about this subject should be compelled to spend an evening in a shooting gallery watching people inject drugs. That was really a life-changing experience. And so that really taught me that, this was a minority population who lived in squalor, obviously had minimal education, minimal or less than or zero employment, terrible lives, probably hungry most of their life. And it made sense to me then, seeing them, that they would take this risk to have a chemical vacation for 3 or 4 hours to get away from the misery of their lives. At least they would have 4 hours of pleasure, even if the next 5 or 10 years were going to be terrible. And so that made a big impression on me. And it, one of the things it taught me is that there's more to drugs than drugs. You can't ignore the fact that our drug problems are so much worse when there's a lot of poverty around and when people are having a really terrible time in their life. It's only natural that there's going to be a lot of drug use and a hell of a lot of drug problems. So I learned so much from visiting the United States. And that's also why I'm here today.
you mentioned a couple of bits about some Australian, but what is Australian drug policy like? What is it like down there? I mean, I think that outside of Crocodile Dundee, Americans, I mean, we know where you are, mostly. What's it like down there?
Well, there was a big change in 1985 when the daughter of the then prime minister was found, the public discovered that the daughter had a serious heroin problem. And that problem extending to the first family in the land was a national psychodrama. And that precipitated a huge amount of discussion. And out of all of that came an agreement on the 2nd of April 1985 to put together alcohol, tobacco, prescription, and illicit drugs all under the one roof, which had never been done before. Very important, very sensible. And that idea has spread around the world, not completely, but to some countries. And also on that day, 2nd of April 1985, we adopted a official national drug policy of what was called harm minimization, later defined to be a combination of reducing supply, reducing demand, and reducing harm, supply reduction, demand reduction, and harm reduction. So that was all adopted in 1985, and that's made a huge difference. But as in many other countries, the evolution of drug policy is not linear. It's zigzag. So there are periods of a few good years, often interrupted by a few terrible years, and then a few more good years. And the truth is that we were among the world leaders in the 1980s, and now many other countries have gone way ahead of Australia. But there are, Australia has some protections. We've got a very good universal healthcare system, which was introduced from 1974, and then it was scrapped, like yours is now being scrapped, and then it was reintroduced again in 1983, and that system has been built on, and that's protected drug users and families of drug users a lot by having a universal healthcare system. So that's equivalent to, say, your Affordable Care Act, had that been Obamacare, had that actually extended to the whole population rather than some of it. And so that's a protection. And also the other thing that's protected the population is that whilst inequality is considerable and growing, still growing, it's not as bad as in the United States. And we haven't had the hollowing out of incomes of middle-income and low-income people as you've had in the United States. So that's been that's provided a lot of protection. Having said all that, though, the other important thing is that there's been what you might call creeping decriminalization. We have, let's call them eight states. In fact, two of those eight states are territories, which is a subtle legal difference. But anyway, let's call them eight states. So these eight states are where most of the drug law activity goes on. And many of those states, in fact, all of those states have passed to a greater or lesser degree some decriminalization of drug use and possession. So people still get charged somehow, but the severity of the penalty has been wound right back, and it wastes a lot of taxpayers' money still, but it doesn't punish people as severely as you would know about it in the United States, with so many people, 700,000 people in the United States having minor drug offences every year. So we've still got a lot of work to do in that area, but the starting point in Australia for drug law reform is nowhere near as bad as you have in the United States. That's the bottom line, that in some ways drug law reform is much harder to advocate for in Australia because things aren't so obscenely extreme as they are in the United States.
You are listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Our guest is Dr. Alex Wodak. He's a physician, a pioneer in the harm reduction movement, and the president of the Australian Drug Law Reform Foundation. We're talking about the philosophy behind and the evolution of harm reduction. Up in King County in Seattle, Washington, they are moving forward with plans to set up supervised consumption facilities, supervised injection facilities. Now, Australia, am I misremembering? But there were nuns running a supervised injection facility down there some time back.
Close. It wasn't quite that way, but what happened was that in the 1990s in Australia, we had a glut of heroin, and heroin became much cheaper than usual and very much more available than usual. And we had a spectacular increase in heroin overdose deaths, like you're now experiencing in the United States with heroin and prescription opioids, with, I think, 52,000 deaths from opioid overdose per year, staggering, and still climbing. So we had that in the that kind of thing in the 1990s, and 10% of the deaths in the whole country. Australia's a country of 7.5 million square kilometres, so it's almost as big. It's 2% smaller than continental US. That is the 48 contiguous states. And 10% of the deaths in the whole country occurred within a 2 kilometer radius of King's Cross, which is where I'm speaking to you from. And so we knew we had to do things across the country, but we had to do something in King's Cross, and that something was obviously a drug consumption room. It had been recommended by in a inquiry that was run by a very high-ranking judge, and in 1997, and then it got stalled politically in the politics of it, and so we started an illegal drug consumption room in the basement of a church. Why a church? Because in medieval times and beyond, churches have been regarded by many theologians as real sanctuaries for people in some kind of trouble. And the pastor who was running that church was a strong believer in that tradition, so he agreed to allow us to establish a drug consumption room in the basement of that church. So we did that in May 1999, went back on the agenda, and then it was approved in on July the 27th, 1999. And then the head of the congregation for the entity of the Vatican that is was the successor to the Inquisition intervened, and that was Archbishop, he was the person who went on to become Pope Benedictine the Sixth, and so he was then the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and he wrote to the nuns in my hospital and said, if you do that, you will be crossed off the list of Catholic institutions, and the property that they owned would then vest to the Vatican. In other words, the nuns would be penniless and be thrown on, have nowhere to live. So they very reluctantly agreed to give up their auspicing of this centre, and so it got taken up by another religion, Uniting Church, and it was opened in May 2001. It's been a spectacular success. There have been a dozen or so independent inquiries into it, and the investigating researchers ran out of superlatives to heap upon this centre. It was obviously providing considerable benefit, and they struggled to find any negatives about this centre. And we're now having a debate about having, 16 years later, about having a second one starting in Melbourne, which is about 800 kilometres south of us. So it's been quite a lesson here. And the lesson I draw out of it is just how hard we have to work in drug law reform to get the smallest benefit, to get the smallest policy change, whereas our friends in law enforcement, all they have to do is roll over and someone will drop gold bars on them, make whatever policy change they want. That's now starting to change a little bit, and it's very heartening to know that Seattle might have the first drug consumption room in the United States, and then let's hope that idea will spread across major cities in the United States and maybe even some small cities, wherever the drug market is so big that it spills over into the neighborhood, and where drug problems are really very difficult for the residents and the business operators in that area. So I follow this very closely in Seattle, and I hope you're going to be successful. We know that there are going to be a major expansion of drug consumption rooms in Canada over the next few years, and there are going to be more drug consumption rooms in Vancouver and also in Toronto and Montreal and Ottawa, many other cities. And really all of this should have happened 20, 30 years ago. And I visited the first drug consumption, official drug consumption room in the world, which is in Bern, Switzerland, last year. I'd been there before to see it. And it's really very inspiring. And if you ever get the chance, I think you're much better off doing that than spending time in Vienna at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. Well, I think you're in for one of these zigzags that I was talking about a few minutes ago in the United States over the next 4 years during the Republican administration in Washington, D.C. So a lot of the advances that have been made in drug policy in the last 8 years are going to some extent, remain where they are, or if the Republicans have their way, will be wound back, unfortunately. But in the rest of the world, it's clear what's happening. And the people who are opposed to harm reduction and opposed to drug law reform are in the retreat. Every year, there's fewer and fewer of them. They have less and less voice in the media. Not many people take them seriously. And their arguments are threadbare. I mean, I realized a long time ago that the scientific debate over harm reduction was over. Harm reduction won, and the anti-harm reduction people lost heavily. And then a few years later, we had the same kind of intellectual debate around the world regarding drug law reform. It's very clear that the supporters of drug law reform clearly have won that intellectual debate, but the political debate is much more complicated and much more drawn out, and that's still going on in many countries, including yours and mine. But we know how this movie's going to end. It's going to end with victory for harm reduction and drug law reform, but it's going to take many, many decades to achieve that victory. And when we look at similar battles over similar kinds of issues, public health, morality sort of debates, abortion and even the civil rights issue, treating minorities decently, these battles take a long, long time to play out.
I've been speaking with Dr. Alex Wodak. He's an emeritus consultant, the Alcohol and Drug Service at St. Vincent's Hospital, a visiting fellow at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales. He is president of the Australian Drug Law Reform Foundation. He is a drug policy and harm reduction expert who has been involved in these things since before it was politically popular. And you are absolutely one of my heroes. Yeah, how do people keep up with you? I know you're on Twitter, but give us your Twitter address if there's the website for the foundation, and give me any closing thoughts you might have for listeners.
Well, my closing thought is we really need to get more people engaged in this issue, fighting it at every level. We're losing a great soldier at the end of next month when Ethan Edelman steps down from the head of the Drug Policy Alliance. And he's been a major figure within and beyond the United States. And we simply need more Ethan Edelmans within the United States and outside the United States. We need more young people getting into this area, especially. This is a young person's issue, if ever there was one. And we need that fight to be carried out in the North and the South, in the developed countries, in the developing world. It's a very important issue, and it's now, I think, many people can see that it is a winnable issue. 10 years ago, there was very little to show for all the effort we'd put in, but now we're starting to get some dividends in many, many countries. We can achieve a lot acting on our own. We can achieve much, much more when we act as a team and when we support each other in other countries as well as our own. I think that working together really does make us a lot stronger.
Australian Drug Law Reform Foundation is at adlrf.org.au, and I follow you on Twitter, where you are, if I remember correctly, at Alex Wodak with a K.
Yes, that's right.
And Dr. Wodak, I just thank you so much for all that you know and for all that you've done and for all your time.
And thank you, Doug. All the best.
Cheers. Well, that's it for this edition of Free Culture Radio. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Alex Wodak. Many thanks to our engineer. And my thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Free Culture Radio has a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/KBOO Free Culture Radio. Please give it a like. You can find links there to past shows, announcements about upcoming programs and events, and other stuff like news items that may be of interest. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio is produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.